I, depending on context. It is extraordinary to hear Temple speak of this time, or to read of it in her book. When she was three, as an outside chance, although her family did not have much belief in its promise, she was sent to a special nursery school for disturbed and handicapped children, and a trial of speech therapy was suggested. Somehow, the school and the speech therapist got through to Temple, rescued her, she later came to feel, from the abyss, and started her on her slow emergence. She remained clearly autistic, but her new powers of language and communication now gave her an anchor, some ability to master what had been total chaos before. Her sensory system, with its violent oscillations of oversensitivity and undersensitivity, started to stabilize a little. There were many periods of backsliding and regression, but it is clear that by the age of six, she had achieved fair language, and with this had crossed the Rubicon that divides high-functioning people, like her, from low-functioning ones who never achieved proper language or autonomy. With the access of language, the terrible triad of impairments, social, communicative, and imaginative, began to yield somewhat. Temple started having some contact with others, especially one or two teachers who could appreciate her intelligence, her specialness, and could withstand her pathology, her now incessant talking and questioning, her strange fixations, her rages. No less crucial was the emergence of some genuine playfulness and creativity, painting, drawing, making cardboard models and sculptures, as well as unique and creative ways of being naughty. At eight, Temple was starting to achieve the pretend play that normal children achieve as toddlers. But the lower-functioning autistic child never achieves at all. Her mother, an aunt, and several teachers were crucial, but also crucial on the long journey up was the slow development that many autistics show. Autism, being a developmental disorder, tends to become less extreme as one grows older, and one may learn to cope with it better. Temple had longed for friends at school, and would have been totally, fiercely loyal to a friend. For two or three years she had an imaginary friend, but there was something about the way she talked, the way she acted, that seemed to alienate others. So that while they admired her intelligence, they never accepted her as part of their community. I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong. I had an odd lack of awareness that I was different. I thought the other kids were different. I could never figure out why I didn't fit in. Something was going on between the other kids, something swift, subtle, constantly changing, an exchange of meanings, a negotiation, a swiftness of understanding so remarkable that sometimes she wondered if they were all telepathic. She is now aware of the existence of these social signals. She can infer them, she says, but she herself cannot perceive them, cannot participate in this magical communication directly, or conceive the many-leveled, kaleidoscopic states of mind behind it. Knowing this intellectually, she does her best to compensate, bringing immense intellectual effort and computational power to bear on matters that others understand with unthinking ease. This is why she often feels excluded, an alien. A crucial event occurred when she was 15. She had become fascinated with the squeeze chutes used to hold cattle. A science teacher took her fixation seriously, instead of scoffing, and suggested she actually build her own squeeze chute. From this beginning, he guided her from particular considerations of farm animals and machinery to a general interest in biology and all science. And here Temple, still quite abnormal in her understanding of ordinary or social language, She still missed allusions, presuppositions, irony, metaphors, jokes. Found the language of science and technology a huge relief. It was much clearer, much more explicit, with far less depending on unstated assumptions. Technical language was as easy for her as social language was difficult, and it now provided her with an entry into science. But if there was a resolution at this level, with the focusing of much of her intellectual and emotional energy on science, other tensions, anxieties, even agonies remained. With the onset of adolescence, Temple started to confront the realization that she might never lead a normal life or enjoy the normal satisfactions, love and friendship, recreation and society that went with it. This realization may be devastating for gifted young autistic people at this stage, and has been a cause of depression in some, and even of suicide on occasion. Temple dealt with this realization partly by renunciation and dedication. She would be celibate, she decided, and would make science her whole life. Adolescence also taught her that not only her emotional state, but her whole mental and physical being were very finely tuned and could easily be thrown out of balance by certain sensory stimuli, stress, exhaustion, or conflict. The hormonal turbulences of adolescence, in particular, threw her up and down. But there was also a passion, an intensity at this turbulent time. And it was only when she had finished college and was launched on her career, she said, that she could afford to calm down. Indeed, she felt she had to. Otherwise, her body would destroy itself. At this point, she started on a small dose of imipramine, a drug marketed as an antidepressant. In her book, Temple speaks of the pros and cons of this. Gone are the frenzied searches for the basic meaning of life. I no longer fixate on one thing, since I am no longer driven. During the last 4 years, I have written very few entries in my diary, because the antidepressant has taken away much of the fervor. With the passion subdued, my career and business is going well. Since I am more relaxed, I get along better with people, and stress-related health problems such as colitis are gone. Yet if medication had been prescribed for me in my early 20s, I might not have accomplished as much as I have. The nerves and the fixations were great motivators until they tore my body apart with stress-related health problems. I was reminded, reading this, of what Robert Lowell once told me about being on lithium for his manic depressive disorder. I feel much better, in a way, calmer, stabler, but my poetry has lost much of its force. While Temple, too, is well aware of the cost of being calmed down, she feels at this point in her life that it is well worth paying. Yet she sometimes misses the emotions, the frenzies she once felt. The other side of a much retarded development may be a continuing ability to develop social skills and perceptions throughout life, and the last 20 years have indeed been years of continuing development for Temple. 10 years ago, when she first started lecturing, I had been told she often seemed not to be addressing the audience. She would have no eye contact and might actually be facing in another direction. And she could not take questions after the lecture. Now she spends almost 90% of her time on the road, lecturing around the world, sometimes about autism, sometimes about animal behavior. She has become much more fluent in her lecturing style, has more eye contact with the audience, and may even add humorous asides and improvisations. She answers, and if need be, parries questions easily. In her social life, she seems also to have developed so that, most recently, Temple told me, she has been able to enjoy spending time with 2 or 3 friends. But achieving genuine friendship, appreciating other people for their otherness, for their own minds, may be the most difficult of all achievements for an autistic person. Uta Frith, in Autism and Asperger Syndrome, writes, "Asperger Syndrome individuals do not seem to possess the knack of entering and maintaining intimate two-way personal relationships, whereas routine social interactions are well within their grasp." Her colleague Peter Hobson writes of an intelligent but autistic man who could not comprehend the meaning of a friend. Yet it seemed to me as I listened to her that Temple, now in her 40s, had grasped at least something of the nature of friendship. On this note, we had been walking and talking for almost 2 hours. We finished our visit to the university farm and took a break for lunch. Temple, it seemed to me, was happy to stop talking, stop thinking for a while. There had been an almost ferocious intensity in the self-examination I had forced on her, although it was not unlike the self-examination she forces on herself daily, struggling, as always, to understand and live with autism in a non-autistic world. Normality had been revealed more and more as we spoke, as a sort of front or facade for her, albeit a brave and often brilliant front, behind which she remained, in some ways, as far outside, as unconnected as ever. "I can really relate to Data," she said as we drove away from the farm. She is a Star Trek fan, as I am, and her favorite character is Data, an android who, for all his emotionlessness, has a great curiosity, a wistfulness about being human. He observes human behavior minutely, and sometimes impersonates it, but longs above all to be human. A surprising number of people with autism identify with Data, or with his predecessor, Mr. Spock. This was the case with the Bees, the autistic family I had visited in California. The older son, like the parents, with Asperger syndrome, the younger with classical autism. When I first arrived at their house, the whole atmosphere was so normal that I wondered if I had been misinformed, or if I had not, perhaps, ended up at the wrong house, for there was nothing obviously autistic about them, or it. It was only after I had settled down that I noticed the well-used trampoline, where the whole family at times likes to jump and flap their arms, the huge library of science fiction, the strange cartoons pinned to the bathroom wall, and the ludicrously explicit directions pinned up in the kitchen for cooking, laying the table, and washing up, suggesting that these had to be performed in a fixed, formulaic way. This, I learned later, was an autistic in-joke. Mrs. B spoke of herself at one point as bordering on normality, but then made clear what such bordering meant. We know the rules and conventions of the normal, but there is no actual transit. You act normal, you learn the rules and obey them, but you learn to ape human behavior, her husband interpolated. I still don't understand what's behind the social conventions. You observe the front, but the Bees then had learned a front of normality, which was necessary given their professional lives. They're living in the suburbs and driving a car. They're having a son in regular school and so on. But they had no illusions about themselves. They recognized their own autism, and they had recognized each other's at college with a sense of such affinity and delight that it was inevitable they would marry. "It was as if we had known each other for a million years," Mrs. B said. While they were well aware of many of the problems of their autism, they had a respect for the differentness, even a pride. Indeed, in some autistic people, the sense of radical and ineradicable differentness is so profound as to lead them to regard themselves, half-jokingly, almost as members of another species. They beamed us down on the transporter together, as the Bees like to say, and to feel that autism while it may be seen as a medical condition and pathologized as a syndrome, must also be seen as a whole mode of being, a deeply different mode or identity, one that needs to be conscious and proud of itself. Temple's attitude seems similar to this. She is very aware, if only intellectually, inferentially, of what she is missing in life, but equally and directly aware of her strengths, too. Her concentration, her intensity of thought, her single-mindedness, her tenacity, her incapacity for dissembling, her directness, her honesty. She suspects, and I too was coming more and more to suspect, that these strengths, the positive aspects of her autism, go with the negative ones. And yet there are times when she needs to forget that she is autistic, to feel at one with others, not outside, not different. Having spent the morning among beef cattle and planning to visit a slaughterhouse, or meatpacking plant in the industry's euphemism, in the afternoon, we found ourselves a little averse to meat and had a Mexican meal of rice and beans. After lunch, we drove to the airport and took a tiny commuter plane, then drove out to the plant. Temple was proud of its layout and wanted to show me how it looked. Such plants are closed to the public and maintain a high degree of security. Temple had designed the facilities a couple of years earlier and still had her overalls and ID with the plant's insignia. But I was a problem. What was to be done with me? Temple had thought of this in the morning and had selected from her hat collection a sanitary engineer's bright yellow hard hat. She handed it to me, saying, "That'll do. You look good in it. It goes with your khaki pants and shirt. You look exactly like a sanitary engineer." I blushed. No one had ever told me this before. "Now all you have to do is behave like one, think like one." I was astounded at this. For autistic people, it is said, have no pretend play, and here Temple had very coolly, and without the slightest hesitation, determined on a subterfuge, and was all set to smuggle me into the plant. Our entry in the event went off without trouble. Temple drove through the gate with a sublime air of confidence, waved cheerily to the security guard, and was, as cheerily, waved in. "Keep the hard hat on," she said to me when we parked. "Keep it on the whole time. You're a sanitary engineer here." We stopped to lean over the fence where the cattle are corralled outside the large plant building, and then followed the path that the cattle follow when they go on their last journey, up and up a curving ramp leading into the main plant building. The stairway to heaven, Temple called it. Here again I was puzzled. The autistic have difficulty with metaphor, it is said, and never use irony. But, looking at Temple's straight, serious expression, I was not sure that, for her, this was metaphor or irony. She had heard the phrase, perhaps it seemed to her, literally true. She describes in her autobiography a similar literalization of a symbol when, as an adolescent, she heard a minister quote John 10:9, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved." And the minister added, "Before each of you there is a door opening into heaven. Open it and be saved." Temple writes, "Like many autistic children, everything was literal to me. My mind centered on one thing. Door. A door opening to heaven. I had to find that door. The closet door, the bathroom door, the front door, the stable door, all were scrutinized and rejected as the door. Then one day, I noticed that an addition to our dorm was being constructed. A small platform extended out from the building, and I climbed on it. And there was the door. It was a little wooden door that opened out onto the roof. A feeling of relief flooded me, a feeling of love and joy. I'd found it. The door to my heaven." Later, Temple told me that she believed in some sort of existence after death. Even if it was only as an energy impression in the universe. Intensely conscious of animals' emotions, their humanity, she had to grant them some sort of immortality too. We walked slowly up by the side of the gently curving high-walled ramp, where cattle walk in single file, blithely unconscious of what is to come, up to the stunner with its lethal bolt. Temple has been a pioneer in the design of such ramps, and her name is associated in the trade with the introduction of curved chutes. As we ascended the catwalk, looking over the chute's walls, Temple told me of their special virtues, how curved chutes prevented the animals from seeing what was at the other end of the ramp until they were almost there, thus preventing any apprehension, and at the same time took advantage of the cow's natural tendency to circle. The high walls prevented upsetting distractions and served to concentrate the animals on their walk. At the top of the ramp inside the building, the animals found themselves moved, almost insensibly, onto a conveyor belt running under their bellies. This double rail restrainer was another innovation of Temple's. A few seconds later, the animal is instantly killed by a bolt, shot by compressed air through the brain. A very similar system, Temple told me, might be used for hogs as well, though typically these would be killed by electrical stunning, not a bolt. She added an interesting gloss. An electroshock machine, such as is used in some psychiatric facilities, and a hog stunner have almost exactly the same parameters, around 1 ampere at 300 volts. A slight misplacement of the leads, she added, and the patient would be killed, stunned like a hog. She was a bit shocked, she allowed, when she realized this. I got a sense of horror as Temple showed me the stunner. But the cattle, she assured me, had no intimation, no apprehension of what was to happen to them. Her whole effort, indeed, was to remove anything that could frighten or stress the animals, so that they could go peacefully, gently, unknowingly to their death. But I still felt queasy about the whole thing. How did she feel? How did others feel working in such places? Temple has explored this and has written a classic paper on the subject. Some employees in slaughterhouses, she notes, rapidly develop a protective hardness and start killing animals in a purely mechanical way. The person doing the killing approaches his job as if he was stapling boxes moving along a conveyor belt. He has no emotions about his act. Others, she reveals, start to enjoy killing and torment the animals on purpose. Speaking of these attitudes turned Temple's mind to a parallel. I find a very high correlation, she said, between the way animals are treated and the handicapped. Georgia is a snake pit. They treat handicapped people worse than animals. Capital punishment states are the worst animal states, and the worst for the handicapped. All this makes Temple passionately angry and passionately concerned for humane reform. She wants to reform the treatment of the handicapped, especially the autistic, as she wants to reform the treatment of cattle in the meat industry. The only fitting approach to killing animals, the only one that shows respect for the animal, Temple feels, is the ritual, or sacred one. It was an enormous relief getting out of the slaughter plant, away from the hideous smell which seemed to permeate every inch of the place, and it made me hold my stomach and my breath sometimes in an effort not to puke. An enormous relief, once we were outside, to breathe the sharp, clear air, untainted with the smell of blood and offal. An enormous relief, morally, to get away from the idea of killing. I asked Temple about this as we drove away. Nobody should kill animals all the time, she said. and she told me she had written much on the importance of rotating personnel, so that they would not be constantly employed in killing, bleeding, or driving. She herself is in need of other atmospheres and occupations, and these form a vital and altogether pleasanter part of her life. Her understanding of the psychology and behavior of herd animals is sought not only by feedlots and slaughterhouses all over the world, but by sheep shearers as far away as New Zealand, and by game parks and zoos. I had the feeling that she might like to spend time on the African veldt, as a consultant on elephant herds and prey animals like antelopes and wildebeest. But would she, I wonder, be able to understand apes, who have some theory of mind, as well as she understood cattle? Or would she find them bewildering, impenetrable, the way she found children and other human beings? With farm animals, I feel their behavior, she said later. With primates, I intellectually understand their interactions. Temple's deepest feelings are for cattle. She feels a tenderness, a compassion for them that is akin to love. She spoke of this at length as we made our way to our next destination, a feedlot. How she sought gentleness, holding cattle in the chute. How she sought to transmit calmness to the animals, to bring them peace in the last moments of their lives. This, for her, is half physical, half sacred, this cradling of an animal in the last moments of its life. And it is something she endlessly tries to teach the people who operate the chutes and the slaughter plants. She told me a story of how one plant manager, while very defensive about being advised on this by her, was fascinated by her power to calm excited animals, and how, unknown to her, he had spied on her through a hole in the ceiling as she worked. This had occurred when she was consulting at a slaughterhouse in the south, and the entire scene and its context kept returning to her mind. She told me the story half a dozen times in the afternoon, each time at length, and in virtually the same words. I was struck both by the vividness of the re-experience, the memory for her. It seemed to play itself in her mind with extraordinary detail, and by its unwavering quality. It was as if the original scene, its perception, with all its attendant feelings, was reproduced, replayed, with virtually no modification. This quality of memory, so akin to Stephen Wiltshire's in a way, seemed to me both prodigious and pathological. Prodigious in its detail and pathological in its fixity. More akin to a computer record than to anything else. Such computational analogies indeed are frequently brought up by Temple herself. My mind is like a CD-ROM in a computer, like a quick-access videotape. But once I get there, I have to play that whole part. She could not just focus, for instance, on the cradling of an animal in its last moments. She had to play in memory the entire scene, from the animal entering the chute and progressing steadily, no fast forward, it takes about 2 minutes, until the death of the animal and its collapse, after its throat has been cut. I can do anything the computers in Jurassic Park do, she continued. I can do all that stuff in my head. I actually have that machine in my head. I run it in my mind. I play the tape. It's a slow method of thinking. But an ideal sort of thinking for much of her work. She designs the most elaborate facilities in her mind, visualizing every component of the system, juxtaposing them in different ways, viewing them from different angles, from near and far. Once the design is complete, she will run a simulation in her mind. That is, imagine the entire plant in operation. This simulation may show an unexpected problem, and when this happens, she will pinpoint the problem, modify the design, do another simulation, several simulations if need be, until the design is perfect. Only now, when all is clear in her mind, does she make an actual blueprint of it. No more attention is needed at this point. The rest is mechanical. Once I get the basic thing laid out, I just put it on paper. I can listen to the TV. There's no emotion in it. I just turn on my son's workstation and do it. But this sort of simulation or concrete imagery is much less appropriate when she has to do other kinds of thinking, symbolic or conceptual or abstract thinking. To understand the proverb, "A rolling stone gathers no moss," she said, I have to run a video of the rock rolling and getting the moss off before I can think of what it means. She has to concretize before she can generalize. At school, she could not understand the Lord's Prayer until she saw it in concrete images. The power and the glory were high-tension electric wires and a blazing sun. The word trespass, a no-trespassing sign on a tree. When Temple lectures, she often uses very odd slides, mixed in with the usual diagrams and charts. Slides that might bear no discernible relation to her theme and might convey nothing to her audience, since, in fact, they are designed not for them but for her, private jottings or mnemonics for her own trains of thought. For instance, a joke slide of a roll of toilet paper made from sandpaper reminds her to speak about tactile sensitivity in autism. In her autobiography, and more concisely, in a 30-page article published a little before the book, My Experiences as an Autistic Child, which appeared in the Journal of Orthomolecular Psychiatry in 1984, Temple indicates how, even as a child, she scored at the top of the recorded norms in spatial tests and visual tests, but did rather badly in abstract and sequential tasks. Such profiles are characteristic of autistic people. They tend to show scatter or extreme unevenness on so-called intelligence tests. In some cases, Temple writes, the scores were misleading because tasks that might have been very difficult for her if she had done them in the normal way were easy because she did them in an idiosyncratic visual way. Thus, sentences and poems and strings of numbers instantly generated visual images. And these were what she remembered, not the words or numbers as such. Complex calculations, impossible for her in the normal way, might become possible if she transformed them into visual images. Visual thinking in itself is not abnormal. And Temple was quick to point out that she knows several non-autistic people, engineers, designers, who seem able to see what they need to do to make designs in their mind and test them in simulations just as she does. Indeed, she often gets on very well with such people, especially her friend Tom. He is a powerful creative visualizer like her, and is also like her, unorthodox, roguish, fond of pranks. I get on the same wavelength as Tom, Temple said, though it's a childish wavelength. But above all, she enjoys working with Tom. This, too, is childish, but a form of childishness that is essentially creative. Tom and I are little children, she said. Concrete is grown-up mud. Steel is grown-up cardboard. Building is grown-up play. I was moved by Temple's words, with their lovely analogizing of creativity and child's play, and thought what a healthy development this had been in her. And moved, too, when she spoke of her relation to Tom. I wondered whether, indeed, she loved him, and had ever thought of a sexual relationship or marriage with him. I asked her about this, asked whether she had ever had sexual relationships, or dated, or fallen in love. No, she said. She was celibate. Nor had she ever dated. She found such interactions completely baffling and too complex to deal with. She was never sure what was being said or implied or asked or expected. She did not know at such times where people were coming from, or their assumptions or presuppositions or intentions. This was common with autistic people, she said, and one reason why, though they had sexual feelings, they rarely succeeded in dating or having sexual relationships. But the problem was not just in actual dating or relating. "I have never fallen in love," she told me. "I don't know what it's like to rapturously fall in love." "What do you imagine falling in love is like?" I asked. "Maybe it's like swooning? If not that, I don't know." I thought the phrase falling in love, with a suggestion of overwhelming feeling or transports, might be the wrong term to use. I amended my question to, what is loving? Caring for somebody else? I think gentleness would have something to do with it. "Have you cared for somebody else?" I asked her. She hesitated for a moment before answering. "I think lots of times there are things that are missing from my life. Is this painful?" "Yeah, I guess." Then she added, "When I started holding the cattle, I thought, what's happening to me? Wondered if that was what love is. It wasn't intellectual anymore." She is wistful about love, in a sense, but cannot actually imagine how it might be to feel passion for another person. "I couldn't understand how my roommate would swoon over our science teacher," she recalled. She was overwhelmed with emotion. I thought, "He's nice. I can see why she likes him." But there was no more than that. The capacity to swoon, to experience a passionate emotional response, seems diminished in other areas too, not merely in relation to other people. For after speaking of a roommate, Temple immediately said, "It's similar with music. I don't swoon." "She has absolute pitch," she added. "This is normally very rare, but is relatively common in people with autism. And a precise and tenacious musical memory. But on the whole, music fails to move her. She finds it pretty, but it evokes nothing deep in her. Only literal associations." "Whenever I hear that Fantasia music, I see those stupid dancing hippos. It doesn't seem to call her. She doesn't get music," she said, "doesn't see what it is about." One might suppose that Temple is simply not musical, despite her absolute pitch and her ear. But her inability to respond deeply, emotionally, subjectively, is not confined to music. There is a similar poverty of emotional or aesthetic response to most visual scenes. She can describe them with great accuracy, but they do not seem to correspond to or evoke any strongly felt states of mind. Temple's own explanation of this is a simple mechanical one. The emotion circuit's not hooked up. That's what's wrong. For the same reason, she does not have an unconscious, she says. She does not repress memories and thoughts like normal people. "There are no files in my memory that are repressed," she asserted. "You have files that are blocked. I have none so painful that they're blocked. There are no secrets, no locked doors. Nothing is hidden. I can infer that there are hidden areas in other people, so that they can't bear to talk of certain things. The amygdala locks the files of the hippocampus. In me, the amygdala doesn't generate enough emotion to lock the files of the hippocampus." I was taken aback and said, "Either you are incorrect, or there is an almost unimaginable difference of psychic structure. Repression is universal in human beings." But having said it, I was not so sure. I could imagine organic conditions in which repression might fail to develop, or be destroyed, or be overwhelmed. This seems to have been the case with Lurius Mnemonist, who, though not autistic, had memories of such vividness as to be inextinguishable, even though some of these were so painful that they would surely have been repressed had this been physiologically possible. I myself had a patient in whom damage to the frontal lobes of the brain released some of the most deeply repressed memories, memories of a murder he had committed, and forced them upon his terror-stricken consciousness. I had another patient, an engineer, with massive frontal lobe damage from a hemorrhage, whom I would often see reading Scientific American. He was still well able to understand most of the articles, but he said that they no longer evoked any sense of wonder in him, the very sense that formerly had been central to his passion for science. Another man, a former judge who is described in the neurological literature, had frontal lobe damage from shell fragments in the brain, and in consequence found himself totally deprived of emotion. It might be thought that the absence of emotion, and of the biases that go with it, would have rendered him more impartial, indeed uniquely qualified as a judge. But he himself, with great insight, resigned from the bench, saying that he could no longer enter sympathetically into the motives of anyone concerned, and that since justice involved feeling and not merely thinking, he felt that his injury totally disqualified him. Such cases show us how the whole affective basis of life can be undercut by neurological damage. But there is something much more selective about the affective problems in autism. There is by no means an overall flatness or blandness, despite Temple's comments about the emotion circuit or amygdala. An autistic person can have violent passions, intensely charged fixations and fascinations, or, like Temple, an almost overwhelming tenderness and concern in certain areas. In autism, it is not affect in general that is faulty, but affect in relation to complex human experiences, social ones predominantly, but perhaps allied ones, aesthetic, poetic, symbolic, etc. No one indeed brings this out more clearly than Temple herself. Both as a person struggling to understand herself and as a scientist exploring animal behavior, Temple is constantly exercised by her own autism, constantly seeks models or similes to understand it. She feels that there is something mechanical about her mind, and she often compares it to a computer, with many elements in parallel, a parallel distributed processor, to use the technical term, seeing her own thinking as computation and her memory as computer files. She surmises that her mind is lacking some of the subjectivity, the inwardness, that others seem to have. She sees the elements of her thoughts as concrete and visual images, to be permuted or associated in different ways. She believes that the visual parts of her brain and those concerned with processing a great mass of data simultaneously are very highly developed, and that this is generally so in autistic people. And she believes that the verbal parts of her brain and those designed for sequential processing are comparatively underdeveloped, and that this, too, is very common in autistic people. She is conscious of the stickiness of attention in herself, so that there is great tenacity on the one hand, but a lack of agility and pliability on the other. She ascribes this to a defect in her cerebellum, the fact that, as an MRI has shown, it is below normal size in her. She believes such cerebellar defects are significant in autism, though scientific opinion is divided on this. She feels that there are usually genetic determinants in autism. She suspects that her own father, who was remote, pedantic, and socially inept, had Asperger's, or at least autistic traits, and that such traits occur with significant frequency in the parents and grandparents of autistic children. Though she feels early environment in pigs or people plays a crucial role in psychic development, she does not hold, as Bruno Bettelheim did, that parental behavior is responsible for autism. It is more likely, she thinks, that autism itself presents barriers to contact and communication that parents may be unable to penetrate, so that the entire range of sensory and social experiences, especially holding and deep pressure, becomes severely impoverished. Temple's own formulations and explanations generally correspond with the range of existing scientific ones, except that her emphasis on the necessity of early hugging and deep pressure is very much her own, and, of course, has been a mainspring in directing her thoughts and actions from the age of 5. But she thinks that there has been too much emphasis on the negative aspects of autism and insufficient attention or respect paid to the positive ones. She believes that if some parts of the brain are faulty or defective, others are very highly developed, spectacularly so in those who have savant syndromes, but to some degree in different ways in all individuals with autism. She thinks that she and other autistic people, though they unquestionably have great problems in some areas, may have extraordinary and socially valuable powers in others, provided that they are allowed to be themselves, autistic. Moved by her own perception of what she possesses so abundantly and lacks so conspicuously, Temple inclines to a modular view of the brain, the sense that it has a multiplicity of separate autonomous computational powers or intelligences, much as the psychologist Howard Gardner proposes in his book, Frames of Mind. He feels that while the visual and musical and logical intelligences, for instance, may be highly developed in autism, the personal intelligences, as he calls them, the ability to perceive one's own and other states of mind, lag grossly behind. Temple is impelled by 2 drives. A theorizing part of herself, which makes her want to find some general explanation of autism, some key that will be applicable to all of its phenomena and to every case, and a practical empirical part of herself, which constantly faces the range and irreducible complexity and unpredictability of her own disorder, and the great range of phenomena in other autistic people, too. She is fascinated by the cognitive and existential aspects of autism and their possible biological basis, even though she is intensely aware that they are only part of the syndrome. She herself faces, almost every day, extreme variations from over-response to non-response in her own sensory system, which cannot be explained, she feels, in terms of theory of mind. She herself was already asocial at the age of 6 months and stiffened in her mother's arms at this time. And such reactions, common in autism, she also finds inexplicable in terms of theory of mind. No one supposes that even normal children develop a theory of mind much before the age of 3 or 4. And yet, given these reservations, she is strongly attracted by Frith and other cognitive theorists, by Hobson and others, who see autism as foremost a disorder of affect, of empathy, and by Gardner and his theory of multiple intelligences. Perhaps indeed all these theories, despite their different emphases, hover about the same point. Temple has dipped into the chemical and physiological and brain imaging researches on autism, and emerged with the sense that they are still, at this point, fragmentary and inconclusive. But she holds to her notion of impaired emotion circuits in the brain, and she imagines these serve to link the phylogenetically ancient emotional parts of the brain, the amygdala and the limbic system, with the most recently evolved, specifically human parts of the prefrontal cortex. Such circuits, she accepts, may be necessary to allow a new, higher form of consciousness, an explicit concept of oneself, one's own mind, and of other people's, precisely what is deficient in autism. At a recent lecture, Temple ended by saying, "If I could snap my fingers and be non-autistic, I would not, because then I wouldn't be me. Autism is part of who I am." And because she believes that autism may also be associated with something of value, she is alarmed at thoughts of eradicating it. In a 1990 article, she wrote, "Aware adults with autism and their parents are often angry about autism. They may ask why nature or God created such horrible conditions as autism, manic depression, and schizophrenia. However, if the genes that caused these conditions were eliminated, there might be a terrible price to pay. It is possible that persons with bits of these traits are more creative, or possibly even geniuses. If science eliminated these genes, maybe the whole world would be taken over by accountants." Temple arrived to pick me up at the hotel at exactly 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, bringing along some additional articles of hers. I had the feeling that she was incessantly at work, that she used every available moment, wasted very little time, that virtually her entire waking life consisted of work. She seemed to have no recreations, no leisure. Even the weekend she had scheduled for me was by no means regarded as a social one, but as 48 hours allocated for a special purpose. 48 hours set aside to allow a brief, intensive investigation of an autistic life, her own. If she sometimes saw herself as an anthropologist on Mars, she could see me as a sort of anthropologist too, an anthropologist of autism, of her. She saw that I needed to observe her in all possible contexts and situations, amass a sufficient database to make correlations, to arrive at some general conclusions. That I might see, with a sympathetic or friendly eye, as well as an anthropological one, did not at first occur to her. So our visit was seen as work, and work to be carried through with the same conscientiousness and scrupulousness as all her work. Though in the normal course of events she invites people to her house, she would ordinarily never have shown her bedroom to a visitor, much less displayed and illustrated the use of the squeeze machine by her bedside. But this, she realized, was part of the work. And though, normally in the course of her own life, she never went to the beautiful mountains of Rocky Mountain National Park, a 2-hour drive southwest of Fort Collins, having no time or impulse for leisure or recreation, she thought that I might like to go, and that this would also allow me to observe her in a quite different context, one in which we could perhaps feel unprogrammed, free. We piled our stuff into Temple's car. With its 4-wheel drive, it was the thing for mountain terrain, especially if we wandered off-road, and took off around 9 for the national park. It was a spectacular route. We climbed to higher and higher altitudes on a hairpin road with terrifying bends and saw towering cliffs with banded rock strata, foaming gorges far below, and a marvelous range of evergreens, mosses, and ferns. I had the binoculars out constantly and exclaimed at the wonders at every turn. As we drove on into the park, the landscape opened out into an immense mountain plateau with limitless views in every direction. We pulled off the road and gazed toward the Rockies, snow-capped, outlined against the horizon, luminously clear even though they were nearly 100 miles away. I asked Temple if she did not feel a sense of their sublimity. "They're pretty, yes. Sublime? I don't know." When I pressed her, she said that she was puzzled by such words and had spent much time with a dictionary trying to understand them. She had looked up sublime, mysterious, numinous, and awe, but they all seemed to be defined in terms of one another. "The mountains are pretty," she repeated. "But they don't give me a special feeling, the feeling you seem to enjoy." After living for 3.5 years in Fort Collins, she said, this was only the second time she had been to them. What Temple said here seemed to me to have an element of sadness or wistfulness, even of poignancy. She had said similar things on the way up to the park. You look at the brook, at the flowers. I see what great pleasure you get out of it. I'm denied that. And indeed, throughout the weekend. There had been a spectacular sunset the evening before. The sunsets have been particularly fine since Mount Pinatubo erupted. And this, too, she found pretty, but nothing more. You get such joy out of the sunset, she said. I wish I did, too. I know it's beautiful, but I don't get it. Her father, she added, often expressed similar sentiments. I thought about what Temple had said on Friday night as we walked under the stars. When I look up at the stars at night, I know I should get a numinous feeling, but I don't. I would like to get it. I can understand it intellectually. I think about the Big Bang and the origin of the universe, and why we are here. Is it finite? Or does it go on forever? But do you get a feeling of its grandeur? I asked. I intellectually understand its grandeur, she replied, and continued. Who are we? Is death the end? There must be reordering forces in the universe. Is it just a black hole? These were grand words, grand thoughts, and I found myself looking at Temple with a heightened sense of her mental spaciousness, her courage. Or were they for her just words, just concepts? Were they purely mental, purely cognitive or intellectual? Or did they correspond to any real experience, any passion or feeling? Now we drove on, higher and higher, the air becoming thinner, the trees smaller, as we moved toward the summit. There was a lake near the park, Grand Lake, which I especially wanted to swim in. I am always excited by the prospect of swimming in exotic remote lakes. I dream of Lake Baikal and Lake Titicaca. But sadly, since I had a plane to catch, we did not have time. On the way back down the mountain, we stopped the car for a brief plant and bird-spotting geological walk. Temple knew all the plants, all the birds, the geological formations, even though, she said, she had no special feeling for them. And then we started the long descent. At one point, just outside the park, seeing a huge, inviting flat sheet of water, I asked Temple to pull over and impetuously scrambled down toward it. I would have my swim, even though we had not made it to the lake. It was only when Temple yelled, "Stop," and pointed, that I paused in my headlong descent and looked up, and saw that my flat sheet of water, my lake, so still just in front of me, was accelerating at a terrifying rate a few yards to the left, prior to rushing over a hydroelectric dam a quarter of a mile away. There would have been a fair chance of my being swept along, out of control, right over the dam. There was a look of relief on Temple's face when I stopped and climbed back. Later she phoned a friend, Rosalie, and said she saved my life. We talked of many things on the way back to Fort Collins. Temple mentioned an autistic composer she knew. He would take bits and pieces of music she had heard and rearrange them. And I spoke of Stephen Wiltshire, the autistic artist. We wondered about autistic novelists, poets, scientists, philosophers. Hermelin, who has studied low-functioning autistic savants for many years, feels that, though they may have enormous talents, they are so lacking in subjectivity and inwardness that major artistic creativity is beyond them. Christopher Gilberg, one of the finest clinical observers of autism, feels that autistic people of the Asperger type, in contrast, may be capable of major creativity and wonders whether, indeed, Bartók and Wittgenstein may have been autistic. Many autistic people now like to think of Einstein as one of themselves. Temple had spoken earlier of being mischievous or naughty, saying she enjoyed this at times, and she had been pleased at having smuggled me successfully into the slaughterhouse. She likes to commit small infractions on occasion. I sometimes walk 2 feet outside the line at the airport, a little act of defiance. But all this is in a totally different category from real badness. That could have terrifying, instantly lethal consequences. I have a feeling that if I do anything really bad, God will punish me. The steering linkage will go out on the way to the airport, she said, as we were driving back. I was startled by the association of divine retribution with a broken steering linkage. I had never thought about how an autistic person with a wholly causal or scientific view of the universe and a deficient sense of agency or intention might formulate such matters as divine judgment or will. Temple is an intensely moral creature. She has a passionate sense of right and wrong, for example, in regard to the treatment of animals. And law, for her, is clearly not just the law of the land, but in some far deeper sense, a divine or cosmic law, whose violation can have disastrous effects, seeming breakdowns in the course of nature itself. You've read about action at a distance, or quantum theory, she said. I've always had the feeling that when I go to a meat plant, I must be very careful, because God's watching. Quantum theory will get me. Temple started to become excited. I want to get this out before you get to the airport, she said, with a sort of urgency. She had been brought up an Episcopalian, she told me, but had rather early given up Orthodox belief, belief in any personal deity or intention, in favor of a more scientific notion of God. I believe there is some ultimate ordering force for good in the universe, not a personal thing, not Buddha or Jesus, maybe something like order out of disorder. I like to hope that even if there's no personal afterlife, some energy impression is left in the universe. Most people can pass on genes. I can pass on thoughts, or what I write. This is what I get very upset at. Temple, who was driving, suddenly faltered and wept. I've read that libraries are where immortality lies. I don't want my thoughts to die with me. I want to have done something. I'm not interested in power or piles of money. I want to leave something behind. I want to make a positive contribution, know that my life has meaning. Right now, I'm talking about things at the very core of my existence. I was stunned. As I stepped out of the car to say goodbye, I said, I'm going to hug you. I hope you don't mind. I hugged her, and I think she hugged me back.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of An Anthropologist on Mars, Seven Paradoxical Tales, written by Oliver Sacks, narrated by Jonathan Davis and Oliver Sacks. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charsick. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1995 by Oliver Sacks. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.